This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, Managing Editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us as we discuss the important events of the week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We have Anthony Chibatterway.
Greetings.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
We're going to start with Richard talking about a hostage situation in France today. Richard.
Yes, so authorities are reporting that there are a couple dead and about 12 wounded as a gunman took hostages in a supermarket in southern France. This is an ongoing story, so there's a lot of details we don't have right now. Just a few minutes ago, the French Interior Minister said that they had now killed the hostage, but he seems to be affiliated to or related in some way to the Islamic State. He took the hostages and he said he wanted the release of Salah Abdeslam. He is the mastermind that was behind the, or at least accused of being behind, the November 2015 Paris attacks. So, and it's another example, just yet another terrorist attack in France. And again, on a very soft target, a supermarket here.
These kind of headlines just aren't going away, are they? We can expect this same type of thing to happen every couple of months, and European politicians have said as much.
Right. It's just the situation. That's just the sad situation right now. When you have millions of Muslims in Europe, when you have even if it's a tiny percentage of a lot is still a large number of those that are potential terrorists. And when targets are as common as a supermarket, like it was in this attack, I mean, you can't secure every single supermarket in your country. So, yeah, it shows the threat Europe's facing. It shows the level of terror Europe is facing. I don't know. There's something more, I think, dramatic and terrorizing about, say, hostage taking and some, you know, we all go shopping. We all go to supermarkets. It's something that you can immediately empathize with the victims, that you can very easily put yourselves in their shoes. So, it does completely underscore the magnitude of the problem Europe is facing.
So it's exactly this type of situation that has a lot of Europeans taking a harder stance against Islam. And this is what we saw this week from a prominent German politician. Richard, tell us about that.
Right. So Horst Seehofer, he's Germany's new interior and Heimat minister. Heimat meaning homeland, but it's a very more kind of an evocative and emotionally connected term in Germany. And this week, or just exactly a week ago, he said that Islam does not belong in Germany. And this caused quite a ruckus in Germany, because Angela Merkel very famously said Islam does belong in Germany. So we've got this new coalition government. We're a week or two into it, and you've got this big contradiction now, and Angela Merkel quickly came out and contradicted her interior minister and said, yes, Islam does exist in Germany. But you've got this big conflict here. And I think what is interesting is, and what we've talked about in the past, is you're seeing Europe being confronted with things like terrorism, with this mass influx of migrants, and then talk about, okay, well, how do we get migrants to assimilate to our culture? And that starts discussions, what actually is our culture anyway? What does it mean to be German? How are we different from these migrants? You know, we maybe don't like some of the things that they do, but what is it that we have in common? And it's spurring this push toward or greater role, public role for Christianity. And that's exactly what the Interior Minister Horst Seehofer was talking about. He said, I'll read the rest of this quote. He says, Germany is shaped by Christianity. That includes the Sunday rest, religious holidays and rituals such as Easter, Pentecost, and Christmas. Of course, the Muslims living within us belong to Germany, but of course that does not mean we give up our country-specific traditions and customs up out of false consideration. So he's out there saying, well, we're a Christian country fundamentally, and that message is really popular. There was a survey published recently that found around 75% of Germans agreed with him. So it may be, you know, Angela Merkel may disagree. It may be controversial even within the Christian Democratic Union political party. But across the country, people like that rhetoric.
And we saw that reflected in the last election.
We did. I mean, one of the most outspoken individuals in terms of talking about Christianity and its role in German culture was Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, who had some very similar comments to Horst Seehofer, where, you know, he gave some big speeches, some packed speeches, some of the most popular speeches of the campaign. And this is exactly what he was talking about, you know, talking about how he didn't like to see, you know, a man walking down the street with his multiple wives covered in burkas, walking a few steps behind him, how Germany needed to not be ashamed of its Christmas festivals and not downplay them as winter festivals. Exactly this, well, exactly the same points as Horst Seehofer. So yeah, this is a popular message right now.
Yeah, you hear something like that from Mr. Seehofer, and that sounds like the voice of the real Germany. That sounds like the voice of future Germany. Angela Merkel saying, you know, no, they do belong here. It's amazing to me that she hasn't changed from that position all along. She's been very welcoming of immigrants and so on, in spite of what happened in the last election and the difficulties that they had in putting this coalition together. She does represent a way of thinking that seems to be confined to a certain segment of the political class and the electorate that is on its way out. Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, especially now with Merkel's party in a grand coalition with the Social Democrats, that does put this anti-immigrant party, the Alternative for Deutschland, as kind of like the leader of the opposition, which makes it a pretty safe bet that they're going to do better in the next election than they did in the last election. And they did pretty good in the last election.
Yeah.
So if Merkel's party has any hope of maintaining power and not having the country become ungovernable as these opposition parties gain more of that vote, they need to start sounding, or pragmatically, they're going to think they're going to need to start sounding more like Horst Seehofer than Angela Merkel if they want to share that 75% of public support.
Yeah, and the pressure's really on Horst Seehofer from the AfD. That's exactly why he's kind of making these moves, and he's been given this new expanded ministry, this Heimat ministry, has more powers than the interior minister, any interior minister has done in previous governments, to try and be in charge of immigration. And his party, the CSU, the sister party of Angela Merkel's union, well, the pressure's really on them because they've got elections next year within Bavaria. And they have ruled Bavaria pretty much since World War II without a coalition partner. Like, that's always been the way it is. They get more than 50% of the votes in Bavaria. And if current polls are to believed, that's not going to happen next election. And the reason for that is they're losing votes to the Alternative for Deutschland. And if they don't get that, that's catastrophic for that party, for their leadership, because, you know, they failed where they've succeeded every year for the last 70 years. So, you know, they're really looking at the Alternative for Deutschland right now, and they are really thinking, we need to reach out for these guys. And that underscores what Andrew is saying. It also underscores just the fragility of this coalition, because you've got them doing that. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the Social Democrats, who are thinking, wow, we need to show that we can make a difference. We had our lowest election result ever. We need to show how kind and welcoming to migrants we can make this government. And you can really see, okay, yeah, there's the coalition is here on paper, but there's a lot of incentives now for a lot of disagreement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the language from Mr. Seehofer about that's overtly Christian and that's talking about a Sunday day of rest. This is really rings in the ears of anyone who's followed the trumpet for any length of time or remembers the words of Herbert W. Armstrong. Put it in prophetic context for us, Richard.
Right. So you look throughout Europe's history, they've always had this strong relation, or very often at their high points of power, they've had a strong relationship with the Catholic Church. And for so many empires, so many leaders, having this European Christian identity has been absolutely core to their success. You know, just about anybody you can think of as a major player in European history has signed an agreement with the Vatican. And the Bible prophesied that. It prophesied of repeated attempts to resurrect the Roman Empire, an empire that spans Europe, and it prophesied that they would work with a huge church to do this. And that's exactly what we've seen. And it said, the Bible says that there will be one more resurrection of this European empire and that they will work with the church. And that's exactly what you see starting to happen now with more of, or moving in that direction with more of this, this talk about Christianity. And the Bible even gets more specific. It talks about this coming European state enforcing Sunday worship. And that being an absolutely core part of what it does. And so, yeah, you see Horst Seehofer mention a Sunday rest as being the first thing on his list about Germany being shaped by Christianity. And that does just leap right off the pages of Bible prophecy. And it is something that we've been talking about for years. So we have our free booklet, or free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, that goes over that history and that prophecy. And then we have our booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, that deals specifically with that issue of a Sunday rest, and how that is prophesied to play a major part in this coming European power.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. Moving on, we are finishing our May-June issue of the Trumpet magazine. We have a major article from Richard called Spiraling into Trade War. Well, the plot thickened this week, creating a lot of volatility in international markets. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we covered just a couple weeks ago about President Trump's announcement that he was wanting to protect the U.S. steel and aluminum industry by putting tariffs on Chinese imports of steel and aluminum into the United States. Well, now China hasn't necessarily taken too kindly to that announcement and have announced some proposed tariffs of their own, which was to be expected. The tariffs they're proposing would be on imports that amount to about $3 billion of value into the United States. They're things like wine, fresh fruit, dried fruit, nuts, steel pipes, ethanol, and ginseng. So things that we don't buy a ton of from China. $3 billion sounds like a lot, but compared to all the billions and billions of goods we import in from China, it's kind of small. This is something that's not going to really like shake up the geopolitical scene, but it is also that Trump's and President Trump's announced a tariff on China, and now China's announcing tariffs back on the United States, kind of as a shot across the bow to see where this could lead as things escalate.
Well, it certainly is an escalation, and it's enough that it has caused quite a lot of consternation among investors.
Right. The markets have definitely taken a hit, and they usually do take a hit when you start seeing the type of headlines we're seeing this week. A lot of you're seeing headlines like Donald Trump starts trade war and U.S. and China at trade war. And some of those headlines gloss over the fact that we've kind of been in a simmering trade war with China for four right. decades.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal's headline was this Donald Trump didn't start the trade war, China did.
Right. China, because of its currency manipulation, it's kept its currency artificially low, which made it so cheap to buy Chinese steel that it's just totally devastated the U.S. steel industry and other industries as we buy from China instead of producing domestically. President Trump's trying to kind of fight back at that with his tariffs, but now China's trying to fight back again with their tariffs. And the headlines are pretty dramatic, which shows why the markets would go down. But as I mentioned before, for the most part at this point, this is things like wine and dried fruit that we don't sell a ton of to China anyway. So it's not going to really start affecting people's personal lives this week, but it does definitely show a direction the world is heading in.
And it's not just China. Is that right, Richard?
Well, it kind of is just China. In some ways, that's the news from today, that America is going, they're going to pause putting these tariffs on the European Union. So initially it looked like Europe would come under the same tariffs at the same time as China. Donald Trump has announced he's not going to put tariffs, at least initially, on the EU, on Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, Mexico, and South Korea. So you're getting more nations that aren't China exempt from this. So in some ways, what I think we've seen over the last few days could be a de-escalation, a step away from trade war. And So Donald Trump is not putting, you know, he's chosen not for now to put tariffs on Europe. I think he will still want something from Europe. You know, it's a pause. He's trying to use that as a chip to get Europe to give something up. And then the Chinese response, I think, was more mild than a lot of people thought that it may be, and more of a token response or a shot across the bows. And so, again, there's still the potential, I think, for a climb down there. I mean, as Andrew said, America has been under attack, under trade war from China, even in many ways from Europe as well, for several decades. He's put up these tariffs to try and stop that. And I think these powers are maybe indicating that they are willing to make some concessions to America rather than risk a full-blown trade war that could seriously harm their economies. I mean, it would seriously harm America too, but it would seriously harm them as well. And I think what you might be seeing is that is Europe and China kind of thinking, we're not yet ready to go toe-to-toe with the United States. So let's make some compromises. We'll maybe take a few steps back from our trade war. And I don't think they'll roll it completely back. I think they'll maybe make some concessions while still punishing the United States, and then maybe start putting plans in place, looking at working more closely together so that they're in a stronger position for when something like this potentially comes up again. Now, there's still, I think, definitely the potential for escalation. Maybe what we've seen over the last few days is the first few steps or first few indications that we could be moving in the opposite direction.
Well, pretty fascinating. Yeah, go ahead, Andrew.
No, you say, yeah, that is the biggest thing to watch for prophetically is that China and the U.S. can't necessarily just go at a trade war alone because U.S. is dependent on Chinese imports, but China is also dependent on exporting goods to the U.S. So as much as these tensions are escalating, they kind of need each other. And the prophecies from the Bible, and they'll have an infographic on this in the coming issue of the Trumpet, shows that going through like Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 shows that China is going to need another trade partner before it's got the heft to actually come against the United States. Mm-hmm. Without devastating its own economy. And that trade partner will be Europe. We've got the chapter in our Mr. Fleury's Ezekiel End Time Prophet booklet titled Superpower Under Siege, showing that it's really this mart of nations between Asia and Europe that could economically besiege the United States. Right now, we're seeing escalating trade tensions between China and the United States, but until Europe comes on board on China's side, you're not going to see a dramatic geopolitical shift in world trade.
Well, it's definitely something to keep our eyes on and watch for because of those prophecies that you're talking about specifically. I would really encourage listeners to stay tuned for this article from Richard Palmer and the infographic that we have in preparation for this next Trumpet issue. It really does provide some outstanding context to all of this. And you watching this unfold, it definitely causes those prophecies to spring to mind and become that much more relevant. While we're on the subject of China, President Xi Jinping recently set himself as emperor for life. And as all of this is happening in the trade front, he's also putting his power to work. We're going to learn about one specific area of prophetic interest from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, he really has set himself as emperor for life. We've spoken about that on a recent episode, how he had the Constitution amended to remove term limits, which would allow him to rule for as long as he chooses. Xi Jinping has also recently had his personal political theory etched into the Communist Party charter, and he's purged the government, really, to remove all political opponents and to stack the upper echelons with loyalists. So all of this adds up to mean that Xi has basically near absolute dominance over China's political system, its economy, and its military. And there are indications that he could use all of this power very soon to grab Taiwan. So just for a little bit of background, the relationship between China and Taiwan has been tense basically for as long as the two have existed as separate nations. And that separation was the result of a civil war that started back in the 1920s, and the Communist Party was on one side, and a party called the Kuomintang was on the other. They fought in mainland China for years, and by 1949, the Communists won. They defeated the Kuomintang, and they forced their members to flee to the island of Taiwan. So ever since then, China, under the Communist Party, has actively claimed sovereignty of Taiwan. China basically sees Taiwan as like an offshore rebel province, and they very often promise to use force to bring it back under Beijing's rule. And on March 20th, Xi Jinping told the National People's Congress that he will push for the reunification of the motherland. And in that same speech, he warned Taiwan that it'll face what he called the punishment of history for any attempts at separatism. So this was it was the strongest warning yet to Taiwan. And these statements come during a time when Xi has been significantly ramping up all kinds of military drills near Taiwan as well. So it's it does look like a big escalation there that could soon erupt into something much bigger.
How much do you feel the change in policy or this intensification of China's stance is a result of Xi establishing the power that he has?
It's a huge part of it. You know, bringing Taiwan under Beijing's control has always been the number one policy goal for the Chinese Communist Party. But for Xi Jinping's predecessors, the previous leaders of China and of the Communist Party, they were able to kick the can down the road and sort of leave reunifying Taiwan, which would be very, very difficult militarily. They were able to leave that as a goal for future leaders. But it's different for Xi Jinping now. Since his term limits were removed, he knows that he essentially is the future of China. So there's no one for him to kick the can to. And this may make him feel pressured and compelled to use his vast power to take action quickly. And there are quite a few analysts who believe that that's likely to happen. For example, Hong Kong University professor Ding Xiaoyang explained it this way. He said, quote, "Now that you have almost all the power in your hands and you have all the trusted people on your team, you need to deliver miracles. Xi Jinping needs to deliver something big, and Taiwan is something very, very big."
So it was 20 years ago that Gerald Fleury first wrote about Taiwan. The August 1998 issue, he wrote an article called Taiwan Betrayal. And as you can tell from the title, it was really about the United States and the fact that Taiwan was basically looking to the United States to defend its interests against China. The fact that we see China doing what it's doing now, it really indicates just how much weaker America's position has become, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Were it not for America's protection of Taiwan, China would have taken it decades ago. That's been the only thing that has prevented Chinese forces from invading the island there. But Xi Jinping sees that the United States right now is deeply divided. It's war-weary. America's will to use its power is basically broken. And he sees that U.S. decline happening at the same time as his own power is rapidly rising. So America's decline really is a huge part of why pundits are even discussing the possibility of China seizing Taiwan right now. Because if America were not a kind of a broken power in many ways, this would not even be up for discussion. This week, President Trump did sign legislation that permits high-level exchanges between senior U.S. and Taiwanese government officials. So China very much dislikes this kind of thing. But the U.S. is not the power that it was a few decades ago. And China really seems to think, and rightly so, that America's security assurances are not nearly as threatening as they once were. But yes, that article that Mr. Fleury wrote in 1998, that came just after President Bill Clinton had kind of publicly opposed Taiwanese independence, the first president that ever did that. And in that article, Mr. Fleury writes, "How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? It's going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America." And then from there, Mr. Fleury explained that his assessment was based on a Bible prophecy recorded in the book of Leviticus. This passage says that America would become, you know, just mired in sins, and as a result, its will to use its power would be broken. And I think that back in 1998, when that was written, the idea of Taiwan being swallowed up by China would have appeared possible only in the distant future. But right now, though, with America's security assurances so much in doubt, and with Xi Jinping's power growing so quickly and his willingness to use it growing so quickly, it's easy to see how Mr. Fleury's forecast there could very soon happen. So we'll make sure that we have a link to Mr. Fleury's article, Taiwan Betrayal, in the show notes.
Very good. You can find that on the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. Go visit that. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. In a world of nuclear proliferation, how close are we to actually experiencing nuclear war? Well, an interesting announcement this week from Israel gives us a bit of a peek into the answer to that question. For this, we'll go to Anthony Chibadirwe.
Well, just this week, the government of Israel just removed a ban on the media from reporting on what happened in 2007. So the nuclear threat is not only prevalent today, it was prevalent even back in 2007. On September 5th, 2007, the government of Syria instructed its military to strike at a nuclear site, a secret nuclear site in Syria, and just completely obliterated it to make sure that Syria would never be able to rebuild that facility again. So with the information that we are receiving now this week, with this ban being lifted, we are just seeing how close the world was to a devastating nuclear war. Syria was very serious about nuclear weapons. We know that they have chemical weapons, but they were also interested in nuclear weapons as well. Back in 2004, the intelligence community had been keeping an eye on this, 2004, 2005, and then on to 2006. And now 2007, they did decide that they needed to do something about it. Syria was receiving help from North Korea. In fact, just a few days before the attack, they've been tracking the intelligence services have been tracking a shipment from North Korea that was labeled cement, but we know it wasn't just cement. It was going to that facility in Syria. And then finally, the Air Force did get the green light to drop 17 tons of explosives on that facility. But one of the most significant aspects about this is that it almost never happened. This whole operation could have failed completely. The Israeli intelligence was somewhat reluctant to pursue it. They didn't think it was a big deal, and they didn't even have enough human resources available to continue tracking this. But there were some segments of the Israeli Air Force and the Israeli military that was determined to continue pursuing this, and finally they did. And even before they did, actually, just the day before the attack on September 4th, there was a Fox News reporter who had somehow gotten information about this secret site. Syria wanted to keep it secret, and Israel wanted everything to be kept secret for different reasons. Syria wanted it secret because they didn't want a preemptive attack from Israel. And very few people in the Syrian government knew about it. Even military officials in Syria, some of them didn't know about it because Assad really wanted to keep it secret so that when he finally makes his announcement, no one could stop him. And Israel, of course, wanted to keep it secret because they wanted to strike it before the whole world knows about it. You know how the world treats Israel. In fact, the Israeli intelligence had been talking with the United States government about this and asking the Bush administration about how to go about it. I think President Bush even suggested that Israel take it to the UN Security Council, but Israel was just terrified at that suggestion because it knew that once it goes out there, there's going to be little chance that it can actually do something substantial enough to stop Syria. So thankfully, when Israel heard about this Fox News reporter was asking more about this facility, Israel decided, you know what, let's just do it right away. So the following night, they made this surgical strike at this nuclear facility that, again, was sponsored by North Korea.
It's pretty chilling to think of what would happen if Syria were to have announced itself as a nuclear power. And it seems like had Israel not taken the steps that it did, that that's exactly what we would have seen sometime between 2007 and today, a Syria nuclear power that would completely change the calculus in the Middle East. At the time, Mr. Flurry, Gerald Flurry was writing about this. You mentioned specifically that he said that we really did come close to a nuclear Armageddon here.
Yes, this was a Syria that had strong support from Iran back then. This was a Syria that wasn't in civil war. So it was a Syria that could have done a lot of damage with those nuclear weapons. Mr. Flurry had an article titled Close to Armageddon, and he quoted you referenced The Spectator, which quoted a British source that said that if people had known how close we came to World War III that day, there would have been mass panic. He continued and said that the prime minister at that time really would have been dealing with the bloody book of Revelation and Armageddon. And Mr. Flurry, in his article, he just makes it, he makes the point that this wasn't going to be just a crisis involving one country or even just one region. It was going to pull in a lot of countries who would have been concerned about these biological weapons and nuclear weapons. Mr. Flurry asks, do we really know how insanely dangerous this world is? And that's a big point to consider. He recently wrote a booklet titled Nuclear Armageddon at the Door, and it just shows how dangerous the world is. But he also, in his booklet and in his article, he just mentions that too many times the media uses that word Armageddon just to show how seriously dangerous this world is, and it is true. But if he encourages readers to read on in the book of Revelation to understand what comes after that Armageddon that people often talk about. It is coming, but there is great hope that lies ahead.
Well, thanks for that, Anthony. We'll put links to those two items in the show notes. That Close to Armageddon article from Gerald Flurry and the Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door booklet. Excellent resources, and we appreciate that. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Lots of shakeups within the Trump administration lately. There was a big one announced late yesterday. For this, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yes, just late yesterday, President Trump announced on Twitter, as is his custom, that he has a new national security advisor. General McMaster has been wanting to retire for some time. And so he announced, I'm pleased to announce that effective on April 9th, 2018, Ambassador John Bolton will be my new national security advisor. And Ambassador Bolton, he was a UN ambassador back during the Bush administration, someone we've quoted quite a lot over the years here at the Philadelphia Trumpet for some of his insights into foreign policy. And that is exactly what he's going to be advising the Trump administration now to do is foreign policy. Most of the news coverage has focused in on three things that Ambassador Bolton's really strong on. One, he's a very big proponent of the U.S. alliance with Israel, and as recently as late last year was really encouraging the Trump administration to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He's also not a fan of President Obama's nuclear ideal with Iran. Ray, and he wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal last February saying that we need to get out of this nuclear deal. And not only that, we need to make sure that the Islamic Revolution in Iran is overturned before its 40th anniversary, which is next year. Indicating that he's thinking like Ayatollah Khomeini's theocracy is something that the United States needs to put a high priority on ousting within the next 12 months. Also did an editorial for the Wall Street Journal arguing the legal case for attacking North Korea before they attack us, just saying that if you can make the case that their nuclear program is a threat to the U.S. mainland, that it is perfectly legal for the U.S. military to lead a preemptive strike against North Korea before that threat gets out of hand. Mm-hmm. So definitely some very strong positions with the alliance with Israel, overthrowing the Iranian regime, and putting at least the military option on the table in dealing with Kim Jong-un's dictatorship.
This is exactly the kind of story that when leftist journalists write about it, they use words like Armageddon. I'm pretty sure that they're convinced that a Bolton national security advisor is going to pave the way for World War III. But in a lot of ways, this does reflect a pretty major realization of a lot of Donald Trump's campaign promises. I mean, it seems like John Bolton is about as strongly in line with the things that Donald Trump said on the campaign trail as you could possibly get.
Right. And the Trump administration has had some productive negotiations with North Korea. And I think a lot of that is they just take him seriously because of the strength he projects. A lot of the liberal journalists will say that, like, okay, well, he's talking about war with North Korea and staging a coup in Iran, and that's going to lead to Armageddon. But it is also possible that some of these regimes may back down a little bit if they realize that the United States is taking a strong position.
Well, you do wonder what John Bolton thinks of Donald Trump's overtures to North Korea. He hasn't been a real strong proponent of discussion.
No, I should look into that. I haven't actually heard him his comment on that, although he is a political commentator, so he may have weighed in on that already. It's an interesting development, and we obviously know from Bible prophecy here at the Trumpet Hour that it says in Leviticus 26 that because of the sins of the people, God would break the pride of your power. And for the last several years, few decades, there actually hasn't even been much pride in the power. Mm-hmm. So John Bolton's definitely someone who has some pride in America's power and would advise the Trump administration to use it. But I guess whether that pride's declining or whether that pride's increasing because of the sins of the people, the ultimate prophecy is that it will be broken.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see what happens in the next months ahead. If there is a temporary respite while America regains some of that pride before God snaps it in half, or if that does starts to backfire.
Well, it is really interesting to look at this in light of Gerald Fleury's cover story for the May-June issue of The Trumpet that we're just wrapping up this week. It's a dynamite article with the headline, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. It's got some really powerful revelations in there about just what's happening in the United States under the Trump administration, looked at from a standpoint of biblical prophecy. It's going to be a little while before that comes up on thetrumpet.com, but keep your eyes peeled for that. And I think looking in light of John Bolton joining the Trump administration, it does bring some of those statements that Gerald Fleury makes in that article to light. We shall see. As you said, let's keep our eyes peeled over these next couple of months as to what happens. Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We have lots more to come. Europe wedging its way into Lebanon, Turkey scoring a victory in Syria, a massive energy deal between Russia and China, and a package bomber in Austin. Stick around.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Bible prophesies that Europe is going to make serious inroads into the Middle East, and we're seeing more and more evidence of this taking place. For the latest on this, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so just over a week ago, representatives from about 40 different countries met with the Lebanese prime minister for what was called the Rome II conference. It was held in Rome, and this conference was all about financial assistance for Lebanon. And so the EU pledged about just over 60 million in aid. France set up a 400 million euro credit facility. So that would be, I guess, somewhere probably around half a billion dollars, where they'd be loaning Lebanon money so that Lebanon could use this money to buy French equipment for their armed forces. Britain pledged around $13 million. And so you're getting, you know, you're getting Europe getting involved in this, in Lebanon's military. This is a continuation of a much more long-standing story, though. So you can go back to 2014, where there was this kind of combined deal between Saudi Arabia and France and Lebanon, where Saudi Arabia gave the Lebanese military $3 billion, a huge amount. And the catch was they had to use this for buying weapons exclusively from France. And I think France was involved in this deal as well. I'm not sure exactly how that deal has happened going forward with some of the rocky patches that have gone on now between Lebanon and Saudi Arabia. But you're seeing this longstanding trend of the Lebanon's military looking to Europe and looking to European suppliers. France especially has led the way in getting involved here. And then the Rome conference, this isn't the only conference. So there's a series, a trio of conferences to do with Lebanon that are coming up over the next few months. There's the Rome conference. Then there's going to be the Paris conference, which is about infrastructure investment into Lebanon. And then there's the Brussels conference on helping Lebanon deal with refugees. And there's three things that these three cities have in common. They're all in Europe. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing across this whole host of areas, as Lebanon encounters difficulties or if they want assistance, they're not having meetings in the United Arab Emirates. They're not having meetings in Washington, D.C., though they do also get a significant amount of aid from the U.S. government. But it's Europe that's where they're turning to try and get some of that extra assistance.
So there's obviously a huge presence of Hezbollah there, influenced by Iran within Lebanon. Europe definitely seems interested in trying to break that. It's interesting that they're sending a lot of military aid, and there's evidence of quite a lot of collusion between the Lebanese armed forces and Hezbollah. Europe seems to be banking on the idea that they can be separated and that supporting the armed forces is actually going to be a counterbalance against Hezbollah. Looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, how would you expect this to break? The fact that Europe is so interested is obviously something that is definitely of great interest to us.
Yeah, it could break several ways. And I think we've speculated on breaking several ways. I think we've speculated that maybe Hezbollah could break with Iran. I think we've speculated that maybe Lebanon would kick Hezbollah out. I think there's several different ways that it could happen. And I mean, we have the prophetic outline that tells us that Lebanon is going to be allied with Europe. Exactly how we get to there, I think we don't know the details. But I would like to point you to an article that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote back in May 2014 called Why You Need to Watch Lebanon, which is exactly why we're talking about this now. And he went through that Saudi Arabian deal that we talked about, that massive agreement to give a ton of money to Lebanon to buy French weapons. And he goes through what we're watching for in Lebanon and just, you know, really breaking it down. There's some graphics and talking about exactly how this prophecy is going to play out. And there's prophecies in Psalm 83 that specifically talk about Lebanon being allied with Europe. And so when you see Lebanon turning and going to all of these conferences with Europe, it's, you know, it just leaps off the page of Bible prophecy. So getting that context going and reading about those prophecies, where they are in the Bible, how they apply to Lebanon and Europe today, is just some great background to get on understanding what's going on now within the Middle East.
Thank you, Richard. Visit thetrumpet.com for the link to that article, as well as a link to an article that we have by Callum Wood, Europe Promises Military Aid to Lebanon, that gives a little more context to that story. We'll go back to Anthony Chibadawe now for the latest news out of what's happening in Syria.
Well, it appears that the Syrian President Bashar Assad has been scoring some victories in eastern Ghouta, where most of the fighting has been lately. Eastern Ghouta is an enclave of rebels that is close to Damascus, and it's the last rebel-held region close to Damascus, the capital. And naturally, Assad wanted to make sure that he regains control of that territory, and he has been successful, and has gotten a lot of help from Russia and Iran. And just today and yesterday, we've been hearing about some of the smaller rebel groups in that region have surrendered. They've signed a deal with the government, and now about 1,000 of these rebels are departing, and 6,000 civilians have departed from that region. So that seems like Assad is gaining quite a little bit of territory right there. But he's not the only one. He's not the only one who has been scoring some victories in Syria. Turkey's Erdogan has finally captured Afrin just this past weekend. It's that territory in northern Syria close to the Turkish border that Turkey invaded a little while back because it was really concerned about the situation in Syria potentially spilling into Turkey. So it invaded that territory, and now it is emboldened to do more. There's this report from the New York Times. It says this: the victory has been widely celebrated in Turkey and has further emboldened President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has vowed to take his campaign across northern Syria and even into Iraq. Now, Geopolitical Futures talked a little bit about that, just saying that one of the reasons why Turkey would want to get into Iraq is because of one of its enemies, Iran. We don't know exactly how that's going to play out yet, but I think it's very significant that Turkey now feels more emboldened to put pressure on Iran. And we expect that Turkey is going to be concerned about Assad's gains in Syria. So we can expect from Bible prophecy to see Turkey trying to put more pressure on Syria, because we know that there's going to be some sort of a split between this alliance between Syria and Iran, and Turkey might be the power that makes it happen that way.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on that. If you want more information, you can look at Gerald Fleury's booklet, The King of the South, that explains why we're watching that situation and why we expect Syria to break from Iran. Thank you, Anthony. More evidence this week of the continuing alignment between Russia and China. This is a huge energy agreement. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Russia's massive state-owned company, Gazprom, released a statement on Wednesday saying that 75.5% of the Power of Siberia natural gas pipeline has now been completed. So this is about 1,012 miles of pipeline that have been laid now, stretching from the Shayandinskoy gas field there in Siberia all the way to Blagoveshchensk, which is near China's border. So the pipeline is about three-quarters of the way finished, and when it's all done, it will allow Gazprom to deliver 1.3 trillion cubic feet of Russian gas every year to China. And the contract says that this will last for 30 years. So Russia has lots of energy, vast quantities of natural gas and oil. And China, on the other hand, is very thirsty for energy. So this is a very beneficial agreement for both sides. And Gazprom says the Power of Siberia line will be completed and delivering gas to China by December of next year. So it's less than 2 years from completion.
it's amazing to see this in context with everything else that we've been talking about, the agreements, military, energy, financial, economic, between these two great powers.
That's right. This colossal energy deal is only the latest indication of a Russia-China partnership that's becoming very deep. It was only at the end of the Cold War that relations between Moscow and Beijing began to thaw, but today they're regularly holding very complex joint military drills. They've actually held about 30 military drills together over the last decade and a half. China has also become the Russian weapons industry's largest and most consistent customer. And as we discussed last week, they're working together on a vast uranium mining project in Russia. Trade between them is soaring. And meanwhile, a very close personal relationship has developed between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping. So there is just a great deal of trust and mutual reliance between these two sides. They have forged a Russia-China axis that's basically reorienting 21st century geopolitics.
Well, if you want more information about this, you can go to thetrumpet.com and look for our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. We'll put a link to this in the show notes for today's program. That booklet really gives the Bible's view of why this Russia-China relationship that is rapidly developing before our eyes is so prophetically significant. And we've been talking about this for decades, Herbert W. Armstrong for decades before us. So it really is amazing to see that happening. Thanks, Jeremiah. Terror in Texas this past week. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Austin, Texas was rocked by two more explosions this week before they finally caught the killer. He died in the second explosion, but they're fairly confident they know who it was. The first explosion came in on a Tuesday when a mysterious package blew up on a city street, not actually killing anyone like some of the previous explosions, but this was actually the fifth of a series of six. And then later in the week, the police finally found the serial bomber, Mark Anthony Condit, a 23-year-old white man who got into a car and then blew up the car he was in with his sixth package. But the first four have been unfolding throughout the month and have rallied up a bit of a death toll, killing a 39-year-old black man was died in the first explosion. A 75-year-old Hispanic woman, she was injured, and there was a 17-year-old black man who died in that explosion. And then two other white men injured in the next two. And so the police found a 25-minute confession on the iPhone of the serial bomber, fessing up that it was him and that he had taken these FedEx packages and turned them into some sophisticated bombs and planted them around the city, but still never gave a motive as to why he wanted to do that.
So it seems like the first couple of people who were struck, they were black, and there was some fear that this was racially motivated, but it seems like with everything all said and done and all the facts in, that wasn't what was going on.
Yeah, the Congressional Black Caucus definitely suggested that you should look into the possibility that this was like race-based terrorism. But with the injured, I think it's there were a few blacks injured, one Hispanic woman, and a couple of whites. So right now it looks like he's covered all the major races that have been injured. So in the absence of a motive, it's hard to label this an act of race-based terrorism until they find information as to why he was doing this or if he's just crazy. But there is an article we have up on thetrumpet.com right now where we do bring out the angle from Leviticus 26, 16 or 17, where God's giving all the curses that come on a nation when they disobey his law. And one of those curses is that they will have, he says, I will even appoint over you terror, and you will flee when none pursues you. And so regardless of whether or not there was a motive to these attackers, the fact that there have been six seemingly random explosions throughout the city of Austin has definitely generated a lot of fear and terror in that city, which is part of a larger trend of what you'd call terrorism taking place throughout the nation, whether this is Islamic terrorism or race-based terrorism or domestic terrorism or mass shootings or just people who are insane blowing up packages throughout cities.
Well, that will do it for today's program. Thanks for that, Andrew. I am Joel Hilliker. We'd like you to visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today. You can email us your thoughts on the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatterway, and Richard Palmer.
Great to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure as usual.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of George Orwell. The further a society drifts from the truth, the more it will hate those that speak it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.